Sophie, do you know off the top of your head how many kids Elon Musk has?
Yes, he has fathered at least 12 that we know of, but the number could be higher. I guess to answer your question, he's had 12 kids.
Sophie Alexander knows this number, 12, because she covers rich people for Bloomberg News. And the at least comes into play because Musk's children, unlike their father, are not public figures. But also because there are a lot of them. They're from relationships with different partners and, in at least three cases, with an employee.
So Siobhan Zelis is an employee of his at his company Neuralink. And they have had at least three kids together. Again, the at least number, because this third one that we're confirming in the article we wrote was new. It wasn't previously known, and the baby had been born earlier this year. So Siobhan had been pregnant for, you know, 9-10 months or so. And yeah, no one had known about it. But yes, this is the third baby he's had with Siobhan.
The reason we're talking about this, though, is not just because Elon Musk has a lot of kids. It's that he wants other people to do that too. Sophie just co-wrote a story for Bloomberg Businessweek titled "Elon Musk Wants You to Have More Babies." If you take a close look at Musk, you start to notice that he brings his son X, who he had with the musician Grimes, along to meetings and interviews. He tweets about how a collapsing birth rate is the biggest danger civilization faces. He talks about this stuff at conferences. Musk is espousing the views of pronatalism.
Elon Musk, he's never come out and said, "I am a pronatalist," but of course, because he wants people to have more babies, he is de facto a pronatalist, because pronatalists are essentially just people who think that more babies is good. They're pro more babies.
Musk clearly wants that. His fellow pronatalist travelers are a hodgepodge of Silicon Valley techies, religious conservatives, and right-wing bloggers.
And Musk is sort of like a poster boy for them. He is, you know, among the world's richest people, and he definitely has one of the loudest voices on social media. And so the fact that he is tweeting about this constantly and the fact that he is, you know, talking about this constantly makes him a sort of spokesperson for the movement. And he's kind of like the best spokesperson they could have asked for, because he is really speaking to this fear that the pronatalists have.
And as Sophie has reported, he's putting his money where his mouth is, funding research that could take pronatalism from the fringes to the mainstream. Today on the show, how the world's richest man has given pronatalism a very loud megaphone. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around. You can trace the roots of pronatalism to the 19th century. Back then, WASP elites were concerned about exactly who was having children and how many they were having.
So that's when you had a lot of eugenics and social Darwinism and race science, and people concerned about, you know, there not being enough Anglo-Saxon Protestants compared to Catholics. You know, Teddy Roosevelt spoke to that in the early 1900s with his whole like conversations on race suicide. And then more recently, pronatalism has become a bit more popular in over the past couple decades, just as people notice birth rates declining so much so that populations might start shrinking in some of the world's biggest countries, as long as immigration doesn't hold. So that's sort of where this pronatalism movement has been born out of. That's where it has its roots. And it's really just the idea that people should be having more children. And the reasons why they should be having more children varies, but that is the essential, the core of it that brings all these groups together.
In your reporting, you traced Elon Musk's interest in pronatalism to a rather large donation from the Musk Foundation to something called the Population Wellbeing Initiative. What can you tell me about that?
So in 2021, Musk's foundation, the Musk Foundation, made a $10 million gift to the Population Wellbeing Initiative. And so $10 million for Elon Musk, who has hundreds of billions of dollars, is not a huge chunk of money. But because Musk hasn't done all that much philanthropy at this point, and he hasn't given this much to a university ever before, this amount really stands out. And it is like the first time he's really making a big push for this pet cause he's taken of population issues. The gift that he made was to actually start this initiative at UT Austin for a group of researchers to look into what is happening in the global population, essentially. And publicly, the Population Wellbeing Initiative presents itself as a very, you know, normal, nothing to see here research group. And then privately, in emails that we've seen between Musk Foundation representatives and the leader of the Population Wellbeing Initiative, they sort of are more explicitly linking this back to Musk's interest of making people more concerned about population decline.
Tell me a little bit about the PWI's work. What are they doing?
They're not so different from any research group except for the subject matter. So they're a bunch of demographers, and demographers are the people who study population issues. They put out research papers on subjects ranging from, you know, animal welfare to things that sound more like Elon Musk's tweets about how population is going to collapse and all these people aren't going to live because people aren't having these babies.
The director of the Population Wellbeing Initiative is economist Dean Spears, a professor with ties to the effective altruism movement.
He has written a New York Times op-ed. He's writing a book for Simon & Schuster, which is significant because it's not, you know, this isn't an academic publisher. This is Simon & Schuster. This is for regular people. The other thing is that we have this other guy, Mike Garuso, and he is another researcher with the Population Wellbeing Initiative. And he's actually been spending the past year in the White House, in the Biden administration, on the Economic Council of Advisors. And he is helping put together this economic report. And in the report, they're citing a lot of research from the Population Wellbeing Initiative and Dean Spears. So they're really like doing their best to have a wide reach with their research. But yes, they're doing research, they're holding conferences, they're writing papers, books, etc.
You mentioned effective altruism, which is a philosophy that has become extremely influential in Silicon Valley. We have had some big effective altruism proponents on this show. And how do those two things, do you think, intersect, pronatalism and effective altruism, where they are trying to think of effective altruism proponents are trying to do the most amount of good, they say, for the largest amount of people. And often that takes the shape of looking into the future.
This really gets into the long-termist branch of effective altruism. And Will MacCaskill, the Oxford philosopher who is, you know, one of these prominent people in the world of effective altruism, he wrote this book, What We Owe the Future. And in it, he talks about, you know, future people and what we owe them. And this is an influential book, not just for Musk, but also for the people at PWI. They, you know, Dean Spears, the guy who runs it, knows Will MacCaskill. They've corresponded as far as we can see in emails. Dean has, you know, worked with other Oxford philosophers in the EA space. But in terms of Will MacCaskill's work, you know, they're citing, you know, specifically things that Will MacCaskill is writing in his book about effective altruism and then plugging it into their research papers and saying, well, you know, all of these lives might not be lived if we continue to have the same birth rates that we have today. And we should all be afraid of that. But in terms of effective altruism and the pronatalist movement, there is like definitely this branch of the more so the techies, the technologist people in the pronatalist world, like Simone and Malcolm Collins, who are pretty famous for the, like, are they, aren't they eugenicists press and, you know, doing a lot of genetic testing on their embryos to figure out, like, you know, educational attainment and things like that. They are firmly in effective altruist camp. So there's a lot of just like intersecting circles. Here you have effective altruists, pronatalists, and of course the techies all overlapping, and Musk sort of falls into all of these things.
Do we know how big the pronatalist movement actually is? Obviously, Elon Musk commands a lot of attention, but how large is the footprint of this school of thought?
At this point, I think it's fair to say they're still pretty fringe. They had their very first natal conference in December of last year, and that was around 100 people at a hotel in Austin. And, you know, by comparison, you look at the Population Association of America, which holds an annual conference bringing together demographers from around the world, and that was thousands of researchers. And we're talking like legitimate academic researchers at schools and universities around the world coming together, as opposed to the natal conference is, you know, right-wing bloggers and divorce attorneys who are blaming no-fault divorces for the decline in birth rates. You know, when I spoke with Simone and Malcolm Collins, they were very quick to say, look, we're not just a bunch of eugenicists and racists and misogynists. Like, there are actually people here who want to make a difference. And the, you know, people who were the racists and the misogynists make up a very small portion of the people who showed up to the natal conference. So they are trying not to police too hard on who can be involved, but they are aware of their negative and fringe reputation at this point.
You mentioned Simone and Malcolm Collins. They are a couple in Pennsylvania who I think often are brought out as the face of this movement. Why do you think we tend to see just a few people putting their names and faces on pronatalism? Because I see them again and again. Is this because just a few people are interested or just a few people are willing to be public?
I think it is just because Simone and Malcolm are the loudest voices in the room here. I mean, of course, after Musk, but they're the ones who are really trying to come out and be like, look, like, we need to talk about this, and we're not afraid to make you scared, and we're not afraid to be called eugenicists. I think there are a lot of people who are, you know, less willing to engage with the public on the subject for fear of being cast as race scientists, eugenicists, or just like hard right conservatives.
When we come back, why pronatalism is attractive to Silicon Valley. You mentioned the eugenicists and the racists, so let's talk about them. One of the things that comes up in the press coverage of pronatalism is whether this is just about white people having white children and kind of untangling this complicated Venn diagram between, hey, let's have more kids, and the history that kind of goes behind that, the Teddy Roosevelt stuff you were alluding to.
Demographers themselves will say that the root of their whole academic field comes from a lot of nasty stuff, including eugenics and race science and people being concerned about the wrong kind of people having all the babies. That's just like the beginning of this. And that's why so many demographers are very concerned about all of this sort of fear that's being injected into the conversation around pronatalism or around declining fertility rates, rather. And that's because they're afraid it will be weaponized to have similar conversations of, well, who is having the babies? Because the fact of the matter is, if you look at the global population right now and where it's growing and where it's shrinking, we are still a growing global population. It's just that most of that growth is happening in the global south, in countries in Africa, you know, where the birth rate in, you know, certain parts of Africa is like 6 babies per woman. So it's far from declining or far from shrinking below the replacement rate.
All of this raises the question, why are pronatalists so concerned about a dwindling population when the data doesn't support that worry? The answer might be in Musk's own words.
Musk has you know, tweeted things about the Great Replacement and has tweeted things about being concerned that immigration is outpacing births in the US. And so you sort of have to ask yourself, well, okay, is that why we're concerned about the birth rate shrinking? Then that makes me nervous about this just being a race science conversation. But if you ask pronatalists about this, they would say, well, is it really fair of us rich Western countries to depend on immigrants coming in and propping up our birth rates? Like, that's not sustainable. So that's what their argument would be. You know, when I spoke with Simone and Malcolm Collins, they said, yes, our concern is the global economy. We're afraid of what's going to happen when the world's biggest consumers are shrinking in population. What's going to happen to the global economy if there aren't enough, you know, Americans to prop up the global GDP?
Why do you think this has caught on in Silicon Valley or in people who are maybe not physically in Silicon Valley, but are interested in tech?
In the tech world, there's a lot of dystopian, you know, fantasies about like how everything could go wrong. Like there's nuclear war, there's like a really bad disease, there's all of these things, and like a population shrinking, and is actually like one of those just like narrative threads of like doomsday scenarios. And I think it is easy to catch on in Silicon Valley and in tech circles, because for one, there are some tech solutions or like, you know, markets for like synthetic wombs and things like that and genetic testing that is exciting to a tech mind. There's also the whole effective altruism thread of it, which has become pervasive in Silicon Valley and tech circles. There's also the, just the fact that tech people are also largely money people. Mm. And like, if you're a capitalist in Silicon Valley, you might be concerned about the fact that there are fewer people being born in the US compared to other poorer countries. And that is actually what Malcolm Collins was. He was a venture capitalist in South Korea when he first became concerned about this.
The title of the piece you and Dana Hull wrote for Business Week is Elon Wants You to Have More Babies. How many babies in Elon Musk's ideal world should I have?
He has said that he thinks that rich people and smart people should have at least 3 babies. Hmm. 3 is the number he keeps bringing up. I think part of that is just the fact that replacement rate is 2.1 babies per woman.
To stave off a declining population?
Exactly. And so if you have 3 babies, then maybe you're making up for the people who are only having 1 and yada, yada, yada. But 3 is the number he comes up with.
So much of this seems at odds with a planet that is groaning under the weight of its current population.
Yeah, so that's the conversation that the antinatalists will bring up a lot. They would say that, you know, we have too many people, there aren't enough resources, and having more children and an even faster growing population would be irresponsible for the planet. You know, we are already running out of our carbon budget. How are we going to, you know, reduce emissions if we have more people? So that is like the counter argument here. And like on both sides, there's just fear injected into the conversation. And that is the concern that is held among these experts in the field. We don't want concern. We don't want fear on either side. We don't want pronatalists or antinatalists. We want to look at the numbers and understand what's going on without people being afraid, because that's when the danger comes in.
Sophie Alexander, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you guys so much. I appreciate it.
Sophie Alexander is a reporter for Bloomberg who covers rich people. And that is it for our show today. What Next TBD is produced by Evan Campbell, Patrick Fort, and Shayna Roth. Our show is edited by Paige Osborne. Alicia Montgomery is vice president of audio for Slate, and TBD is part of the larger What Next family. And if you want to grow our family, I have a request for you. Become a Slate Plus member. Just head on over to slate.com/whatnextplus to sign up. We'll be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.